Welcome to the IMD Podcast Network, where we navigate the complexities of modern business and management. In each episode, we'll bring you insights, strategies, and candid conversations designed to empower leaders and drive innovation. In today's episode, Professor Howard Yu is talking to historian-turned-business professor Martin Gutman about busting the hero myth and why the biggest headlines go to the world's worst leaders. Along the way, he'll reveal how humility is the ultimate power skill and give leaders a playbook for quietly, predictably winning.
Ever wonder why we sometimes cheer for the wrong kind of leaders? You know, those big talkers who swoop in during a crisis and soak up the spotlight? Why the quiet, steady people doing the real work barely get any credit? If you're nodding your head right now, you're gonna love today's guest. Dr. Martin Gutman is here to turn our idea of leadership on his head. He's a Swiss-American historian-turned-business school professor who wrote this eye-opening book, The Unseen Leader, back in 2023, and delivers a powerful message. The most effective leader aren't the loudest, flashiest hero we imagine. And guess what? People are listening. His TED Talk rake up some 1.6 million views online and spark a global conversation on how we've been celebrating the wrong traits all along. I think in 2025, his insight is ever more important. And so get ready for a fun eye-opening conversation. He's going to unpack and help us to rethink what it means to lead. So let's welcome to Dr. Martin Gutman.
Thank you so much, Howard. It's really a great pleasure to be here with you today. Thanks for the invitation.
Martin, I know you're a big fan of your work. Your book about Unseen Leader really opens my eyes because it challenges me how I view around effective leadership. But for our listener, if there's one thing after our conversation you want them to have a little bit of a key takeaway, change the way they view world leader, business leader, even the way they lead their team, what would be that one thing you want our leaders to, or listener, to come off with?
It would be to resist the temptation to confuse a good story with good leadership. Often, good leadership results in a bad story. What do I mean by that? Good leadership usually circumvents drama and a crisis and all of these things that make a story exciting. And exciting stories are very often the result of poor leadership. People who failed to heed a crisis, failed to make the right decision, and find themselves then making a lot of noise to try to extricate themselves from that.
Oh my God, this is so suitable for right now, 2025. When you study history, world history, you talk about economics and maybe it's strategic rivalry across countries and nation. Maybe it's just demograph, right? It's the aging population. No politician can change that. And what is some of the example you've seen that good nation leader pull the right lever? What are some of the typical lever that a politician or country leader could actually pull?
So an example here I like to cite is actually Churchill.
Mm.
And obviously there's been a lot written about Churchill. He's, I think, rightfully so, one of the most studied leaders of the 20th century.
And he wrote a lot. I mean, my God,
yes.
I had no idea until someone told me, he's a Nobel Prize winner in literature.
That's right.
I always thought he's just a military person.
No, and he actually made the bulk of his money in his lifetime through his writing.
No
so
way.
So he's a writer and he's a historian.
Really?
Absolutely, yes. And I think, to be fair, you know, his influence on the 20th century wasn't just positive. I mean, he was deeply involved in the British colonial endeavor in India, in South Africa. So he also spent a good part of his life making people miserable around the globe. But in the Second World War, in London, I think he, above any other political leaders, was the architect of the Allied successful conclusion to the war.
What do you mean by that?
Well, what I mean by that is, and this gets back to this idea of pulling the right lever.
Yeah.
In our common retelling of the Churchill story, we tend to focus on his speeches, on his rhetoric.
Like, that's right.
Here was a guy who was able to rally through his words. He grabbed the steering wheel of history. He gave these dramatic speeches. He hounded his generals to go on the offensive. And that's why the British won the war.
That's right.
I would say that's a very small part of his success. Because if fighting words could win wars, then Hitler and Mussolini would have won. They were the masters at this, right?
True.
At, you know, captivating a crowd and using this action-oriented
historical with this information and charging people's emotion.
Exactly, exactly. So, of course, you know, being a good communicator is necessary to be a political leader of a country at war. However, if we look more carefully, and this is not just at my work, but at the historians who have really examined the granular steps that Churchill took to win this war, he did two things. One, he decided already in the summer of 1940 that he needed to, in his words, drag the United States into the war.
Really?
Yes. There's this famous retelling by his son, Randolph, where Churchill was shaving one morning and Randolph asked his dad, how are you going to win this war? You know, we just lost the bulk of our army on the shores of Dunkirk in France. You know, Hitler is ruling the entire continent. What are you going to do? And he said, as he was shaving, I'm going to drag the United States into it.
Because at the time, United States is very much isolationist.
Exactly.
They want to stay away.
Exactly.
They want to profit from the chaos of the world and don't want to get dragged in.
That's exactly right.
Huh.
And that's where we have to resist this, telling of the story from the perspective of today. We know the U.S. entered the war. We know they fought alongside Britain as the dominant partner to defeat the Nazi Empire. But that was not a given in the summer of 1940. Hmm. And Churchill launches this, what we today would call an advocacy campaign, strategic, long-term, persistent campaign of influencing the U.S. from the top leadership, from Roosevelt all the way down to the average person on the street, to bring them into the war. And think about it this way. When the U.S. finally enters the war in 1941, it's because of the attack on Pearl Harbor.
That's right.
That was the Japanese.
Mm-hmm.
Hitler had nothing to do with that.
Mm-hmm.
So why, after Pearl Harbor, does the U.S. declare war on all the Axis powers and commit themselves to fighting Europe first?
Ah.
They put the bulk of their resources and military power into defeating Hitler and the Nazi regime first. That is Churchill's work.
That is interesting.
Yep.
That is so interesting. Because what you're just telling me is that we cannot just take history or even current event, whatever is the dominant narrative, and take it for granted. And what you showed us right now is that what Churchill have done and the eventual history, how it unfold, it comes down to leader to understand what are the major lever that I'm going to push. Maybe it's behind the scene that ultimately buy us the victory.
That's exactly right.
Wow. That takes a very different profile of almost like self-control, you know?
Yeah.
Because as a business school professor here, we kind of go through a number of, you know, change management literature, what makes company great. And there is almost this, you know, insatiable need for action.
Yeah.
Bias for action.
Yes.
But then at the same time, through your story is, if I'm going to make the right move, I probably need to slow down. I probably need a cool head. I don't want to fumble left and right and destroy the existing strong base. That requires a different type of outlook. But I guess my question to you is, why do we human, or at least contemporary world of business or even world economics, why do we have this insatiable need for action? Why do we always need, hey, leader, do something. you know, with all this technological upheaval, with all this geopolitical tension, it's almost like, CEO, you must do something. Why do we, instead of demanding leader to slow us down, do the right thing, what's wrong with us? Even like we as followers demand leaders to do fast action. What is going on there?
No, it's a great question. And I think the first thing to say is action is not always wrong, right? If you are on a sinking ship, that's probably not the time to call an all hands on deck meeting and deliberate, you know, what steps should we take? You grab the bullhorn, you tell people to evacuate and other people to, you know, I actually don't know exactly what you do when a ship is sinking, but you got to get moving, right? Because time is running out. But that's not the day-to-day reality in business and in countries, right? And if you're always behaving as if your ship is sinking when it's not,
right,
that can be very disruptive because, first of all, it teaches everybody else below you that this is what you do as a leader. You create noise, and if there is not a crisis, then you talk about things as if there is, because that's how you get attention, that's how you get promoted.
But this takes my breath away, because in a way, this makes sense. And I totally can see the destructiveness of people trying to stir up a crisis. But at the same time, I bet our listener also have heard about so many times, oh, we couldn't change because there is no sense of urgency. Or the words I've heard, we need a burning platform.
Yeah.
We need people to feel uncomfortable and having a sense of urgency. But what you're saying is, wait a second, that burning platform, whether it's real or not, is actually not something you should desire.
If the platform you are standing on is actually burning, you probably don't need to tell people. They're already jumping into the
sea. People know it.
Exactly.
People can see it on a day-to-day basis.
Exactly. So there, I think the leadership challenge is more, you know, maybe you and your team have noticed a development that really will impact your business, but nobody else is seeing it. Then, sure, it is your job to communicate that.
And in your work, you illustrate there are leaders in the quest of glory and victory, like, you know, exploration of the poles, North Pole, South Pole. There are leaders who self-inflict a lot of crisis and eventually, of course, human cost, casualty all the way. And there are leaders who are just quiet. They are just doing the not so glamorous work, but based on evidence and prepare themselves. Tell me a little bit about that story.
Yeah. I think it goes back to the point of confusing a good story with good leadership.
Mm.
And maybe before we look at the context of explorers, as you mentioned, or contemporary leaders, just imagine that we're not talking about leadership now, but we're talking about crossing a river.
Great.
And, you know, this is a wild river. There's some hidden rocks and some hidden currents.
Yeah.
And we've got one guy who just takes a quick look and then says, all right, I'm going to go for it, and just starts swimming across. You know, about halfway through, he's getting yanked left and right by the current, starts flapping his hands around in a desperate attempt to save himself, making lots of noise, then drags himself back to where he started from. We're going to notice that guy, and we're going to say, wow, look at that guy.
Right.
He fought so hard to save himself from that river.
That looks so good. If I got it on video, I'm going to post it on Instagram.
Exactly. And like, wow, this guy is really brave. He really took action and he saved himself. Now, if we have another swimmer who has taken a lot of time to understand the river, understands how the currents flow, understands where the dangerous rocks are, and can use the currents and subtle movements to make it across without any noise, if we even notice that swimmer, we'll probably say, man, that looks pretty easy. I can do that. Right? And I think that applies to leadership as well, right? The guy who just rushes in creates a lot of noise because suddenly he's in all kinds of danger.
Right.
We're going to admire him for all the brave action he took to save himself or the organization. Whereas the other person makes it look easy. It doesn't look hard. It looks inevitable. So transition.
And that makes a lot of sense, Martin.
It does.
Because I was thinking about in the business world environment, say you are an IT manager or a risk manager, right? The last thing I want a risk manager to do is to self-inflict a lot of dangers for the organization, and he or she saved the day.
Yep.
I don't need that.
Right.
Because your job is to make sure maybe is, you know, the operational risk is keeping minimum, the server for the computers always run, fan off all the cyber attack before it became a crisis, not letting our data, client information leak out and become a headline news, and then you come save the day.
Yeah, yeah.
But your story is so powerful because in today's world, 2025, we forgot about the fundamental.
Totally. Yes. Yeah.
Oh my gosh.
No, and you asked about the explorers that I've looked at. So, you know, I teach at business school like you do as well. And one of the things that I've noticed and that I, you know, enjoy is that there are actually a lot of historical case studies, for example, from Harvard Business School, where various historical leaders are profiled. And the interesting thing to me is there are a lot of case studies used in business schools to teach leadership that profile Ernest Shackleton, the Anglo-Irish explorer.
Oh, yeah. I remember that.
You remember that?
So right? Brave.
So brave.
So heroic.
And that is a great quality. I mean, he was persistent. He was able to keep people motivated in a real crisis. And maybe to take a step back just to tell his story, he set off on the so-called Endurance Expedition in 1914, right at the start of the First World War. His ship, the Endurance, got trapped in the ice, the pack ice, before reaching the Antarctic continent. And from then on, this epic adventure followed where he and his crew had to trek across, you know, desolate, icy landscapes.
And of course, as British, they are so proud of their steam engine and thought their ship can just crank through any thick ice.
Exactly. Yes. No, and that's the point, right? It's an epic adventure. It's a great story. However,
it's romantic.
Oh,
the story is almost romantic.
It's, I mean, if I were looking for an upcoming Hollywood movie,
right,
I would do it on Shackleton.
Oh, I couldn't wait to see.
No, it'd be amazing, right? However, if we take a more granular view, we will see that this wasn't just bad luck. The reason they got stuck, and we have to say that Shackleton set off for the Antarctic Peninsula four times in his career, every time he failed.
Really?
Yes. The first time he wasn't the guy in charge, but it was still a failed expedition. Every time there was near death or also death on the expedition. So this is, you know, we're celebrating a guy who has a track record of failure, and not failure because of unfortunate circumstances, but because of poor decision-making, poor preparation. So in the Endurance Expedition, he makes fundamental errors in the equipment he brings, in how he trains and selects his crew, in the instruction he gives them. It is his fault that they get stuck in the ice.
Oh,
it's
my God.
Admirable that he gets them out of there once they do, but I don't think he's the guy we want to celebrate and learn from if it comes to good leadership.
But the scary thing about this part of the story is that imagine the people who back his expedition four times.
Yeah.
It's like, okay, you didn't succeed the first time. I'll give you a second chance. Second time around, didn't happen. The third time, didn't happen. And the backers continue to believe in him. Gosh, what a great storyteller,
yeah,
right?
Absolutely. And, you know, contrast this to whom I think is, I don't think there can be any meaningful debate about this, the single most accomplished explorer of all time, the Norwegian Roald Amundsen.
From Norway,
exactly. Mm. There were, at this time, this is around, you know, the beginning of the 1900s, there were four goals in polar exploration, the North and the South Pole and the Northeast and the Northwest Passage.
Right.
Roald Amundsen in his career achieves all four of those goals.
Hmm.
Three of them, he is the first to accomplish. There is no drama. There's, you know...
Wait a second. Is that because he's got better technology than the British? He's got bigger team. What's going on there? I mean, nature is nature, huh? So, I mean, conventional logic, if you get more money, better technology, you win.
That there's many things that are going on here, but it's certainly not good luck, and it's certainly not access to technology the British didn't have. I mean, he is an individual entrepreneur, if you will, from an impoverished country.
That's true. Back then, there's no oil yet.
There is no oil yet, right? And when he's born, it's part of Sweden. You know, it's essentially an extension of the Swedish monarchy. It's a poor, impoverished outpost that lives on fishing and a few other natural resources.
Right.
The British expeditions are usually funded by the Royal Geographic Society or the Royal Navy, has access to state-of-the-art technology.
How did he overcome all this challenge?
Yeah, I think it goes back to this idea of before you take any action and before you're overly focused on the action I can take, you know, understand the environment.
Okay. Right?
And so, for example, the Northwest Passage, this passage across the northern tip of Canada, which the British had essentially spent a century and over a dozen expeditions to try to find, Roald Amundsen sets off in 1903 and successfully navigates. He's the first to do so in a tiny fishing vessel that is quite old by the time, right? But how does he understand the environment in a different way? He understands that in the far Arctic North, mobility is reduced to a few weeks per year. The rest of the time, you are stuck in place. You're frozen in place. So the first key to successfully navigating the Northwest Passage is not thinking about navigating. It's about thinking, how do I overwinter successfully or even comfortably? And the British expeditions, they have a different logic, right? They go with this kind of overkill. We're going to bring 5 years worth of tinned food from London. We're going to bring dynamite so that we can blow ourselves out if we get encased in the ice, right? They bring libraries. They bring these giant steam engines in their ships, right? But you can't really bulldoze your way through the ice. You have to accept the fact that you are going to be stuck for 10 to 11 months before you can move again, right? So what do you do? Well, you have to adopt some of the Inuit technologies, including clothing, and including food choices.
Like the native, how they live in the Arctic.
Exactly.
Ah.
So with Amundsen, we see this pragmatism that he is very willing to adopt some native technologies.
And it's not fashionable.
Fashionable at all. I mean, you can imagine how the British feel about adopting anything non-British.
That's right.
Non-Starbucks.
At the height of the empire,
exactly.
Right? So we're going to bring in our latest tech, hoarding everything expensive and heavy, and
exactly.
Try it in a place that they had no experience before.
Exactly.
I would imagine all this like dynamite and steam engine, whatnot, right?
Yeah.
Is used and deployed in temperate climate.
Yeah.
It's the first time they bring it to the Arctic.
Exactly. And you're totally right that they kind of bring the wrong thing. So one early Northwest Passage expedition, that of Franklin, which ends up, it's called the Lost Expedition because he and his ships are lost. They're not discovered until about 100 years later, so the entire crew is dead. He has about 120 crew members to try at this Northwest Passage. Amundsen later has 7. Among these 120-some crew members that Franklin brings, he doesn't bring a single person with experience in Arctic hunting.
Are you serious?
That seems like a bit of an oversight.
That's crazy. Yeah.
Whereas Amundsen, he selects his crew from northern Norway. They're all used to growing up in long, dark and cold winters. They're all expert skiers, and if they're not, he trains them to be that, right? But it's not just about sort of adopting, you know, Inuit technology and being used to the dark. He's also very willing, and that's why I use the term pragmatist, to use modern technology where it seems to suit him better. So he uses a small marine engine as opposed to steam engine, which is, it's new, hasn't been tested, but he figures the ability to start it immediately is what I need. For steam engine, it takes hours to build up a head of steam for you to move. And that's what dooms Shackleton, right? When they're stuck down off the Antarctic.
Because you burn all the diesel before you could move, and slow and clunky.
Yeah, exactly. So yeah, that's right. And but that's just one minor aspect here,
right?
the technological choices. But we can look at staffing, at kind of the culture within his team, at his choice of equipment, and so on and so forth. And we see somebody who is very much in touch or in has a true appreciation for the challenges that his endeavor is going to face, and he tailor makes his team and his decisions to meet those challenges.
So I would imagine Roe-Amundsen expedition must be a lot less exciting, must be almost boring. You have this guy with a bunch of sled dogs, with some much less glamorous technology, prioritize rest for the crew so that they don't exhaust it for no good reason.
Yeah.
And it must be on headline news. I don't know. It sounds like a boring expedition. Who's going to write about it?
Yeah. That's exactly right. I mean, if you read his diaries, sure, they're interesting, but Shackleton's story is way more exciting. Right? So again, if you're looking for a script for a Hollywood movie, go for Shackleton, go for Franklin. If you're looking for leadership lessons, I would go with Amundsen.
So I'm just going to pause you here a little bit because it basically challenged a lot of the contemporary leadership behavior we aspire. Whether it's bias for action, whether it is about being just courageous,
yeah,
or being authentic, this is who I am. It seems like all the things that the media and even social media are chasing after could get us to a rabbit hole. So if you would have an advice for people who are leading a small team, like I may not leading a Fortune 500 companies, but I might have a team of 10 or even 5. Is there like a sort of a mental checklist that I'm going to look at so that at least I am aware and not to miss the red flag?
Yeah. This is interesting, right? Because it's not just about how we should behave as leaders, but what you're suggesting is also we need to be careful about the environments we place ourselves in. It's not to end up in a doesn't even have to be a toxic culture, but in a culture that celebrates crisis response and celebrates those who make the most noise and everything else.
And we pay so much premium on charismatic leader.
Yeah.
I think these days.
Absolutely.
Is not enough that we do smart preparation.
Yeah.
Unless you're going into a crisis mode, unless we're going into a wartime situation, it's not heroic enough.
Yeah.
What you suggest is, no, you don't need to. I mean, if your goal is to generate prosperity, is to win market share, is to going into places that we never explored before, our energy would be much better invested in smart preparation.
Yeah.
Getting onto the ground, understand what is going on, what is the situation we're facing.
Yep.
So is that checklist that you usually use in assessing historic figures? Like you kind of know, before I finish my deep research on this guy, these are the red flags I might pay attention to.
Well, so what I do, I think we can look at this from the historical perspective, and then we can take it to, you know, the contemporary scenarios in this small team that you mentioned. I think in the historical realm, what I do when I look for insights around leadership, and I often, you know, ask questions beyond leadership, just about the human interaction with technology and with change and continuity, but leadership is a big part of that. But what I try to do is I don't focus on an individual simply because they are popular, right? So I think the mistake we often make in selecting historical figures to profile and to celebrate and to learn from as we take the ones everybody else is already talking about, right? But the danger there is the reason people are talking about them is because they created a lot of noise and found themselves in very dramatic circumstances. So I start with the question, in this period that I'm interested in, a certain war or revolution or some complex time, which individuals do professional historians consistently single out as having had the most meaningful impact? Right? Because a lot of historians, they don't really care for all this leadership hype. Right? They're looking very soberly at this event in its entire complexity. And the individuals who emerge on their list as having had the most influence or the most meaningful impact, you know, might not be the ones the Hollywood movies are about. Right? And then I say, okay, so now I'm going to look at that person and see what they did. Right? So that's the first thing. I think first we should even question who are we celebrating? Who are we selecting to analyze and why? That's the first thing we need to be clear about. Now, if we transition to the business world today, I think there's two levels we can examine. The one is how should we behave as leaders who really want to create meaningful impact and not just headlines and sound bites and, you know, attention for the sake of attention.
That's right.
And there, we don't even necessarily need to look at history. History can confirm this, but there's great research, I think, around humility. This is a real superpower for leaders, because in humility, you have an acknowledgement that you alone cannot change everything around you. You need to rely on other people.
Yeah.
And there are circumstances outside of your control. If you are humble in the sense that you acknowledge your faults and your mistakes, you acknowledge your limitations, that spreads within a team and creates psychological safety, creates this collective humility, and it supercharges productivity.
And what I like about that idea is would that also allow the organization or team to share failure much more on a concrete basis.
Yeah.
So that one person's mistake within the team becomes a lesson learned and inspiration for others.
Yeah.
And this is what a smart company is about. It's not that we get it right from day one, but you learn it, you share it, all the dirty laundry, the beautiful, the good and the ugly and the bad get discussed without blame.
Exactly. No, and this takes me back to your question about a checklist. I would say one item that needs to be on a checklist if we're trying to survey a team or an environment to make a decision, you know, is this a place where we want to work? Is see how do people talk about failures and successes?
Oh, that's interesting.
Team has had, right? If the leader of that team attributes the successes solely to their actions and their decisions, and the failures solely to external circumstances or mistakes by others, that is a red flag for me.
That's good. In the phase of exploring, I could just easily ask people in the targeted firm or targeted team, tell me a little bit about how you describe and discuss about failure versus success.
Yes.
Or I could just ask them, tell me one big failure that the company have done in the past.
And what did you learn from it?
That's such a good question to ask, because what you tell me is through this very innocuous question, it actually tells you a lot about the culture of the organization.
Exactly.
Are we transparent? Are we okay to looking at past failure without blame? Is this a company or organization or team that prize transparency versus secrecy?
Yeah.
That is so powerful.
Yeah. One of the things this reminds me of is I like to think of leaders as having the responsibilities to be the historians in chief of their teams or organizations.
That's so good.
Yeah. And what I mean, of course, they have a lot of other responsibilities as well, but this is one of them. And what do I mean by that? I mean that after a success or a failure, like you just took us through, do the leaders adopt the very superficial retelling of that story that I or Dave made this decision and that led to the success? Or do they take the time to really analyze everybody's contributions, perhaps including Cindy's or somebody else's who didn't make as much noise as David, but perhaps brought that one key idea or that one key intervention into the room that changed the decision-making process over the course of the events? Are the leaders nuanced in how they talk about the successes and failures? And that's why I say they are kind of responsible for not only keeping, but also, writing or telling the real histories of their teams and their organizations. Because if they don't, we're going to adopt these very superficial, heroic type stories, and they will become ingrained in our teams or our organizations' understanding of what drives success in our history.
And it puts the burden or the responsibility almost like, how do we safeguard ourselves against erroneous learning?
Yeah.
Are we honest enough and also thick-skinned enough to pry open a black box, so to speak, and get all the data as we get after the event and do fact-checking, fact-finding, investigation before we think about the future?
Exactly.
This is so cool because you showcase what are the right leadership and what are the admired but less effective leadership. But, you know, when you go through history, obviously, it's written by man. So inevitably, right or wrong, you know, male leaders get disproportionately being covered by historian. If you bring us up to speed into modern days, who are some of the more modern leaders that you aspire to?
I think there are many inspiring women in leadership roles today or in the recent past. So I think if I look back to a recent challenging episode in the globe, it would be the COVID-19 pandemic.
Mm.
Right? And there I really admire the leadership of Jacinda Ardern.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Because she embodied this humble approach to communication and to leadership. I remember this news conference early on where she said something like, "We don't have all the available information.
Right.
We don't know where this is going to go, but I'm going to make the best decision based on the best advice that I can get."
Yeah.
And contrast very sharply to a lot of other male leaders who said, "All right, listen up, people. I know what's happening here. Let me tell you what we're going to do. We're going to do all these 10 things before they really understand what's going on." Right? And that actually doesn't inspire as much confidence as somebody who says, "There are a lot of things we don't know about how this crisis is going to unfold." Sanna Marin in Finland is another great example.
That's right.
Who communicated and led confidently but humbly.
So this is so important as an insight, and I bet a lot of our listeners really want to change the way they lead also. Maybe we could round up a final question is, you know, people prize around authenticity these days. Everyone wants to be authentic. Now, if I were to switch from one way of leading to another, are there any good advice in that transition so that my people still think and see that I am authentic rather than, oh, I just listened to this podcast and I'm crazy?
Well, I like that you frame it as a transition between leadership styles. And I would say that should be the perpetual state that leaders should be going for, in the sense that how you should behave as a leader will often depend on the context you're in. Right? So as we already said, there is a time and a place for screaming loudly and waving your arms around to call attention to what's going on.
Yeah.
Right. But that is not the only way to lead, and it's not always the best leadership mode for the circumstances at hand. So what I encourage leaders to do is really think about not having one leadership mindset, one toolkit, right? But actually being flexible. And the skill you really need to focus on is knowing when to use what tool.
I love it because it does call to point this whole idea of situational leadership.
Yeah.
It's depending on the circumstances, the challenge that I must rise up to, then I need to prepare for a broader repertoire, tools, approach, so that it's not always just a hammer. All right, Martin, are you ready for some rapid-fire question?
I think so.
Okay, so if someone walk up to you and say, an unseen leader, so fill out the blanks for me. An unseen leader is?
Challenging.
Oh, that's a good one. Name me a contemporary leader that you admire.
Claudia Sheinbaum, president of Mexico.
Why?
Because she is both able to be an unseen leader, clearly analytical behind the scenes, but can step up in front of a camera and be as charismatic as the best of them.
I'm going to Google all the YouTube of her.
Nice.
Final question. What is the latest movie or a Netflix series or, you know, TV episode that you binge and love?
I just last night finished The Residency, which is a whodunit in the White House. brilliant.
Love it. Okay. Well, thank you, Martin, for having this unparalleled conversation. I get to learn so much around different leadership style, why it works, why it doesn't work for some others, and let's keep this conversation going.
Always a pleasure. Thank you so much, Howard.
Thank you.
That's all for this week. This podcast was proudly brought to you by the International Institute for Management Development in Lausanne. You can find out more at imd.org.